another episode of Behind the Vinyl, with Darren and Nicholas.
When did you decide to do that?
June. Back in June, yeah.
Oh, right, okay. Okay, yeah. So that's pretty, it's the whole thing has been in the whole COVID thing, you know?
Yeah, and we, I came home from Nashville from recording the Megadeth album, and Tom, he goes, look, you know, this is early June, like first week of June, he goes, look, there's no way we should put this album out because, you know, it'll fall through the cracks. We're going to put it out in October, kind of in between Megadeth touring and everything. And he just said, he goes, there's no way it'll work with no touring. The album will just fall through the cracks. And so we just said, look, let's do some covers. And we didn't think it was going to be a fucking 18 song double CD four side vinyl. We didn't think it was going to be that much, but as with everything in our world, once we start, we go all in, you know. So yeah, it's really turned out to be great. So that was the whole idea with it, you know. And then all of a sudden we realized we started getting so much traction with it, and then we started calling some guests in, because we've been live streams for the David Ellison Youth Music Foundation earlier this year. As part of the Grammy Music Education Coalition, we started doing these live streams, which really brought people together, you know, because everyone's lives were shutting down. The tours were going away. It's just, everybody's just heading into COVID depression, you know, and we found these live streams kept everybody connected. And it's like, hey, let's pull the nose up, man. Let's keep soaring to something. Let's look for something bright here. So, you know, quite honestly, at the end of the year, the no cover record has kind of been the victory lap, sort of, you know, the triumph of something good that we did together as a community. I'm stoked about it.
How did you go about picking the tracks?
You know, the first one was Wasted, which, you know, I told Tom about the relevance of this record. That's why it was his idea to do the cover of the, you know, the On Through the Night homage with my Jackson bass on the truck, just putting the bass on the truck. That took like a week to get that thing on there. Right. You know what I mean?
Phil Cullen, right?
I mean, it's funny. He's a Jackson artist. So he and I are, you know, pretty prominent over there with the Jack, you know, face of Jackson guitars. I only met the Def Leppard guys, Joe and Phil, actually, when 2007, I believe, Jimmy DeGrasso called me and asked me to play bass for Ronnie Montrose because he was playing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I jumped in with Ronnie, and our second and third shows that I did with them were with opening for Def Leppard. Def Leppard had, I guess, personally asked to get Ronnie on the bill. They played Alabama and Jacksonville, Florida, and they were huge fans. So the, you know, second show with Ronnie, the first one was kind of a warm up in St. Petersburg. And then the next show is a big, about 8,000 seats in Jacksonville Arena. And, you know, Joe and Phil come in and they're just gushing on Ronnie, like, oh man, you know, you're our hero. And then I'm standing there just going, fuck, man, like, not only do I love Ronnie, you know, and his first record, but, you know, I'm a huge Def Leppard fan. So it was like just this fandom going on, you know, which was really fun. So it was fun having the Def Leppard guys on the side of the stage watching our set. And, you know, and Phil kind of got to know him probably a little better, you know, than the other guys. So yeah. Good crew there. Yeah.
I think a lot of people think of Def Leppard as Hysteria Def Leppard, you know, with the whole...
Yeah,
maybe more like the big shows and the
right,
you know, and the big hair and all that kind of stuff. But those first couple of Def Leppard records are so good.
Oh yeah, I think, you know, if you're a metalhead, and especially if you're my age and you grew up on new wave of British heavy metal, you know, Def Leppard are very much part of the new wave of British heavy metal. And it's funny, you know, I know I probably know Vivian Campbell now the best, because Last in Line has opened for Megadeth. I've seen them when they've come through town here in Scottsdale. I've gone out to see them a couple of times. And so it's fun. You know, I told Vivian, I said, you know, it's funny. Dave was just mentioning that Def Leppard and Megadeth should go do a tour together. And he said, he goes, right, you know, that'd be great. But, you know, Joe doesn't want to have anything to do with the new wave of British heavy metal. Like, he's completely just distance himself, you know, from that. And I look, I get it, you know, especially and this and On Through the Night, you know, I said, look, you know, we don't play very much off of Killing Is My Business. You know, for us, it was kind of that, you know, the first entrance record. But like On Through the Night, you know, Killing Is My Business has been this silent little cult sleeper classic record of our catalog. And now everybody, even if you're 15 years old and you've just heard of Megadeth, it's like, for whatever reason, they all want to fucking hear stuff off Killing Is My Business, you know? So it's, I hope with this record, we've reintroduced the Def Leppard audience in some small way back to the pre-Pyromania, because, you know, you're right. I mean, On Through the Night and then High and Dry, I mean, those were life-changing records for guys my age who then got into Motorhead and Venom and Iron Maiden, you know, the first two or three Iron Maiden records and the early Scorpions, you know, Love Drive and Blackout, you know, that stuff, you know. So kind of the pre-MTV heavy metal era. You know, the Def Leppard, the On Through the Night is a staple in that, you know.
See them back then?
I did. I saw them on High and Dry. Funny, when I remember seeing, so I saw AC/DC, which is funny, that's why we picked Riff Raff, You know, so back to that first question, you know, I picked songs, and so did Tom, that were not just hits. You know, we didn't want to just play the bar songs that really had impact in our life, in our, both of our lives. So like Not Fragile from BTO, was the needle drop on that record. Riff Raff was the first song I heard by AC/DC when I bought the If You Want Blood record with Bon Scott live album. So with AC/DC, I saw them with Bon open for Cheap Trick. And Cheap Trick was about ready to put out, I guess technically they were still touring on the Budokan Heaven Tonight record, but we're just about to drop Dream Police. And AC/DC was just come to America on the Power Age tour. So essentially touring on that, you know, If You Want Blood live album. So, but it's funny, Cheap Trick and AC/DC both touring on live albums, you know, and then Cheap Trick would drop Dream Police, AC/DC would drop Highway to Hell, you know, a couple months later, and then Bon died and it was over. But it's funny, then I saw AC/DC on Back in Black and Blackfoot opened for them.
Right.
Which would be a good contender for No Cover 2, now that I'm thinking about it. And it's funny, you know, so then I get On Through the Night, and I see that on the back cover of On Through the Night, Def Leppard is on stage with AC/DC, probably on the Highway to Hell tour, because you can tell by the way the SVTs and the Marshalls are lined up next to the drum riser, you know? They came through Minneapolis and I saw them open for Blackfoot on the High and Dry tour. And that was with Pete Willis, the original lineup. So right. Really fucking awesome, man. I mean, so freaking cool, you know. So it's kind of funny when, you know, then a few years later, it's my turn up to bat with Megadeth and seeing Metallica and, you know, Megadeth and everything we were doing. I kind of felt like we were, you know, a bit of the DNA of that early Def Leppard stuff. You know, Def Leppard was kind of at that like parachute pants, Capizios, but moving into arena rock, our look was a little tougher and, you know, more organic, but it's funny how, you know, of course, Mutt Lang took both AC/DC and Def Leppard just to these unbelievable heights, you know? So yeah. It's cool. I'm glad I got to experience that era of Def Leppard.
It's actually Rick Savage's birthday today. He turned 60.
No way.
60. Yeah.
I should send him over a link for Wasted. it's funny. It's funny with that because, you know, a couple of, you know, made me realize, like, you know, people out, hey, who's your favorite bass player? So I was kind of going, all right, Gene Simmons, Geddy Lee, Steve Harris. You know, those are pretty go-to, you know, guys for me. But then, you know, there's other guys, Bob Daisley, you know, for sure, from Ozzy's band. But then a couple of others on here that, you know, kind of got my attention again. Certainly Ian Hill from Judas Priest, Cliff Williams. In fact, I think Cliff's playing on the new AC/DC record is his best ever.
Right.
Just well-played, cleverly placed notes, you know. You know, all of music is three things: what note you play, where you play it, and how long you play it. And it's interesting. Ian Hill plays this just long whole note through all of, you know, it's a very kind of just a nice floor that he lays down to the Judas Priest riffs. Williams, on the other hand, has this kind of staccato, I'm thinking like Who Made Who, for instance, you know what I mean? It's got this kind of shortened length of the note that is, you know, I'd love to sit down with him and watch how he plays. We've toured with him before, and obviously that's a big rock setting, but it's almost like he uses flat wound strings, so it has this sort of like boom boom boom. It's like a trombone, boom 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 boom. You know, he shortens the note just perfectly. And then Rick Savage, you know, who is just, you know, not only plays cool, is a great singer, kind of the second singer of Def Leppard, but also looks like a fucking rock star. And same with Tom Peterson from Cheap Trick. You know, Tom is, again, just a 12-string bass, cool fucking parts, great tone on his records, and just looks like a fucking rock star, you know? And that to me is part of it, you know what I mean? It's like, I didn't want to just be a musician, you know? By the time I picked up the bass, I was already a musician. I'd already been playing keyboard, you know, piano and tenor saxophone. But by the time I got to the bass, I wanted to be a rock star. You know, the bass was a bigger goal than just being a musician.
Love it. That's great.
You're talking Cheap Trick there. I think a couple of those people you mentioned, Bob Daisley, hugely underrated as a bass player. You know, records he did with Ozzy are great, which you covered an Ozzy track on here as well.
Yeah. It's funny. So Max Norman produced several Megadeth records and singles for us. And so, you know, I'd always ask him, me and Marty, especially Friedman, we'd always ask him, like, you know, what did Randy Rhoads use in the studio and how did they play and how did you cut those records? You know, and I recently did a podcast with Max, and he said, he goes, I think Bob Daisley went back and punched in one note, you know, like just played that shit top to bottom, every song. And he's a writer as well. So that's the other thing is I like these bass players, be it Phil Lynott, you know, Rick Savage, of course, is a writer, you know, Getty, Steve Paris, Gene Simmons, these guys, you know, the more famous rock star bass players, but even the guys that are a bit more behind the scenes, like Bob, you know, he wrote the fucking Ozzy lyrics. You know, it's funny with Ozzy, you know, love Ozzy, but Geezer Butler wrote the Sabbath lyrics and Bob Daisley wrote the fucking Ozzy lyrics. So it's like right. The bass players basically gave Ozzy his image and created his whole charisma through the lyrics, you know, and that's not to undercut Ozzy's obviously a great, got great melody and he sings the stuff amazing, but you know, it's I was reading his book for fact's sake, you know, and he talks about just sort of the years of abuse he suffered in and out of there. But he said, he goes, look, I needed a job, you know, so I'd always come back. Every time they called me back to write an Ozzy record, I'd come back and I'd write it. I'd record it. They'd fire me, you know, and they'd call me back. I'd do it again. And, you know, he's like, I'm a working musician. That's what I do, you know. So, but yeah, Bob, you know, and with Uriah Heep, you know, Abominog and that stuff. I mean, and Rainbow, of course, you know, especially Long Live Rock and Roll. I mean, you know, Bob is, when Bob's in the room, man, shit changes. Stuff gets bigger and better because he's not just the bass player. He's also a writer and, you know, really a part of the fabric of the records that he's part of.
You've mentioned Tom a few times. Like Tom's mm-hmm. your singer in your solo band. He's also your business partner in a lot of your ventures, which we'll talk about right. in a sec. How old is Tom?
Tom is 10 years younger than me. So I'm 56. He's 45.
I joke.
If I'm Zach Wilde, he's my Blasco.
he manages me. On these solo things and also, hey, strap up, get on stage, let's go play, you know? So it's kind of funny how that works.
Love it. It's interesting looking at these song choices because there's some here. I knew Tom was younger than you, and I was wondering whether he was aware of some, if Nazareth meant as much to him as it did to you, if Backman Turner Overdrive, you know, was relevant to him at all.
Well, it's funny you mention that because we have noted, you know, this record spans so probably 1974 with BTO, Nazareth, and Sweet FA from those records, all the way up to about 93, I guess, when War of Words with Nailed to the Gun came out. So, you know, two decades, right? So some 70s, 80s into the early 90s. And he did mention that, you know, he said, he knew of obviously BTO Not Fragile, but he didn't know the song really. And he went in and he sang it and he came out and he goes, that's oddly enough, that's becoming one of my favorite songs on the whole record. And we actually put it in the live show a couple of weeks ago when we started playing and we opened up. I said, look, I really wanted to open up this whole middle section because there's a nice bass drum breakdown and we can let Bumblefoot and our other guitar player, Dave Sharp, just go, you know, and just do cut heads and do, you know, rock and roll down at the crossroads and just trade fourths and eighths and go back and forth. And it really has turned into a cool part of the show. You know, when you've got these kind of songs and, you know, if you're a headliner, like we were, you know, you're looking for dynamics in the show, you know, you come out ball guns blazing, you pull it back a little bit. And then it's nice to have a musical moment like that, that really allows for that to happen. And, you know, it's funny in our live show, of course, we're, you know, an original band, but you know, you always got to pepper a few covers in there just to, you know, to kind of either buy some time, or play some things that people are familiar with. And I told the band, I said, hey, look, this is this one moment in time where we legitimately could be the world's greatest cover band in rock and roll. Because we have an album of covers, you know, so it's, I said, let's dig in deep and go for it. So, you know, we played about half of these songs, in the live sets. You know, you're right. With back to the thing with Tom, you know, I joke, you know, I'm a 70s Kiss fan, Tom's an 80s Kiss fan. And he put Beth on here. That was actually his idea. He told me, he said I didn't even know Eric Carr did a version of this. And apparently on Smashes, Thrashes, and Hits.
Yeah.
He recorded a version of it. So it's kind of funny that he went to Eric Carr. And of course, I grew up on Peter Criss because Kiss Destroyer was the first cassette I bought in 1976 with my own money at the record shop. Not Fragile was around me. I had the copy of it. I think a friend of mine had the gatefold of it. A farmhand that worked for my dad growing up had the BTO Not Fragile 8-track. So I'd listen to it in the tractor with him when he was out plowing the fields. Right. And of course, Sweets, I heard on the school bus radio, an AM station, WLS AM out of Chicago. So I'd heard early Sticks, Sweets, BTO, that kind of stuff, you know. So and Love Hurts was just, you know, this ballad. I'd heard the older guys, like farmhands. There's a vocational school in the town I grew up in Jackson. A lot of people from around the country went there to learn various trades. And so the farmers, like my dad, would hire those guys to come out and work on the farm. So I got exposed to a lot of music, a lot of the 70s kind of cool hard rock, because they'd be on the farm listening to the 8-track or having the radio on, and they would be playing this stuff. So that's how I heard like Love Hurts and BTO and a bunch of this stuff, you know, it's from the older guys. Love hurts, love stars.
I like the fact that you, as you said, you didn't pick like the most common songs. You didn't pick You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Right. You didn't pick Action with Sweet. And this is kind of the way I would love radio to be. Not playing the usual, you know, the hits and all that. Dig a bit deeper and find all those cool, really good songs that never get played.
I agree. I totally agree, man. And, you know, we were looking at it and you know, we talked, we said, you know, is it kind of weird we don't have a Judas Priest song on there? I mean, we just did this big show with KK Downing last year. And Tom picked Free Will Burning. Again, an 80s, you know, kind of a later 80s Judas Priest fan, more of an MTV era. He picked that. My choices, of course, are kind of probably British Steel back or Screaming for Vengeance, you know, back to the beginning. You know, that's kind of my era of Priest. But, you know, and then he said, he goes, man, I'd love to do a Quiet Riot or a Wasp song. I said, well, look, let's go for Wasp. And I said, dude, you sing like Blackie. You sound like Blackie. and for me, you know, Love Machine is my favorite. Love Machine and actually Wasp's cover of I Don't Need No Doctor by Humble Pie is fucking amazing, you know? Yeah. So we could almost do a cover of their cover, you know, one day. It's, you know, there's some of those songs. But, yeah, and even like Sheer Heart Attack, you know, for me, you know, Queen obviously is super popular now with the movie out. You know, everybody knows about Queen now, which is great. But, you know, there's many sides to Queen. There's this sort of Broadway side, this very poppy side, you know, Radio Gaga and all that kind of stuff. Some, you know, kind of magic, and that stuff. And then there's the earlier stuff, which to me was Death on Two Legs, Sheer Heart Attack, this heavier stuff. And, you know, that's where I go with it. So, and I always loved Sheer Heart Attack because it was this, you know, first of all, Roger Taylor wrote, played and sang the whole thing. And it sounds more stripped down like something, you know, a guy like me would do, you know, more punk rock, down picking, you know, and that frenzied approach. And, you know, when I asked Tom, I said, how the fuck are we going to do that with the vocals? He goes, dude, Bumblefoot's in our band. I'm like, yeah, yeah, no. So Bumble can sing anything. And as I heard it, I thought, you know, I want to hear a kind of a nice female vocal on the top. So we reached over to Doral. She, you know, happily agreed to do it. She was just on the mega cruise with us a year ago. So we had just kind of reconnected with her. And then, you know, we asked her, said, hey, you want to join in on a Motorhead tune? And when we told her it was Love Me Like a Reptile, she goes, ah, perfect. You know, so that's how rock and roll Doro is. She would sing a song like that, you know, in this day and age with all these prudish fucking politically correct crap going around, you know. Doro's metal, you know, and she was a good friend of Lemmy's. And so, you know, the way I look at it is like, look, if Doro can sing a song like that, get over yourself. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
She's the metal queen, you know?
Got no choice, I'm gonna twist your tail.
she's the nicest girl around. She's the friendliest.
She's just wonderful.
She's just great.
Sweet as can be. You know, we toured in 1988 when she had Warlock. We were touring So Far So Good, So What. They were out with us. Sanctuary, which then became Nevermore. They were our opening group because Dave had produced their first record with Terry Date, ironically, engineering that, who then, of course, would go on to do Pantera and Soundgarden, I think, and all kinds of big stuff. So, yeah, so it's, you know, it's cool, man, to look back. And that's kind of part of what this was when we started, you know, hitting people up to come in and play on it. It, you know, it's funny, it kind of started with one day Tom was on the phone with Charlie Benante. And or maybe they were texting or something. And Charlie was, you know, this again, this is back in June. So it's like, oh, shit, how are we going to try to write, put together an Anthrax record? You know, New York, where some of the band lives, is shut down. L.A. shut down. Charlie lives in Chicago. So, you know, they're trying to write and put records together. And so Tom is like, well, look, man, you want to jump in with me and Ellison and playing a few of these tracks? And, you know, he said, yeah, sure. You know, it sounds easy. You know, that's easy. It's like, we'll just send you the tracks, bang them out, send them back to us. So, you know, Charlie was wonderful to, you know, to just jump in. Of course, we were on the Mega Cruise together, and he and I really hard on putting together the Kiss jam. I was putting together, I was going to do an all-star jam on the Mega Cruise. And, I happened to talk to Frank Bello. I said, man, putting this thing together, and the set list is looking a little too much like a Metal Allegiance set. I don't really want it to be that. And so Frank said, he goes, well, dude, you could always do Kiss, man. Everybody loves to hear Kiss songs. I go, fuck, great idea. So leave it to the Anthrax guys. You know what I mean? So so I then as Charlie and I were, you know, I just started hitting Charlie, and I said, hey, Charlie, I'm going to kind of help have you be my musical director here on this, and kind of help me out putting this set list together and everything. So yeah, so Charlie's great, man. He's a great player and agreeable and easy to work with. And you know, that's what's required to do a record like this. Just say yes and jump in the room and do it, you know.
He's actually on which is one of my favorite songs from the record, Holiday in Cambodia track as well.
He is. Yeah, you know, it's funny, I think I brought up Dead Kennedys, and Tom right away is like, dude, Holiday in Cambodia. I said, yeah, that's the one. He goes, absolutely, 100%. So, it's funny, the Dead Kennedys, of course, it's been an interesting year here in America with everything, election year and everything. But, you know, the Dead Kennedys have this ethnic diversity. Maybe it's because they're from San Francisco, you know, big city. But, you know, back in the day when they formed, you know, they've got four different sort of ethnicities. You know, each member represents kind of that. They obviously play four different instruments, yet their parts they weave together so perfect, like a puzzle. It was really fun to dig into that track. And you know, as simple as each of the parts are, they're very clever in how they work together, you know, harmonically. Da 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 da. You know, the bass part, and then the da 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 da. You know, it's very, you know, inventive, and especially in that day. And of course, you've got a singer who, you know, really brings it out to you. You know, but you know, musically, every person in that band really holds their own and has a, you know, a very cool role in that band. You know, that was one that kind of stood out. Cause as I was digging into these now I'm not just digging into them as a fan, as the, you know, the 15-year-old fan. Now I'm digging into them as a professional bass player, recording artist. These songs will now live forever. So we've got to really dig in and play them right and record them right. And, you know, so there was a few of those that, and also Sweet F.A., you know, Steve Priest, back to bass players, you know, a guy that's, oh, again, fucking rock star, you know, look cool, played cool, sings, you know, again, kind of like Rick Savage, the other singer. So funny that Def Leppard does action, and they, you know, Def Leppard pays a lot of homage to Sweet, you know, because there's, you know, they've kind of got their lead singer, with Brian and Joe Elliott, of course. And then there's the bass player, Rick Savage, and Steve Priest are kind of these other, kind of the second singers of the band. You can tell they're a big part of the writing. So it was fun to dig into Sweet F.A. And when I hit Todd Kearns, you know, who plays bass with Slash, I said, hey, man, would you be up for doing this? And he goes, like, all of it, the harmonies and everything. I said, dude, it's all yours. He goes, challenge accepted.
and then he brought it back. I'm like, dude, you freaking rule, man. So really great, you know. And then, and he, of course, you know, Over the Mountain, Bob Daisley, you know, digging into his bass playing. You know, as a fan of his, I want to learn every note, every slide, all the details of it, you know. So,
yeah,
it was a good education for me, you know, for summer. It's kind of like going to rock school, going away to a rock and roll bass camp, you know, and really digging into all my heroes' songs and, you know, and really, you know, appreciating how they play.
Sweet. Did they ever become as, because they were huge in Europe. They were huge in Sweden. Did they become as big in the U.S. back then in the 70s?
They were pretty big, man. Again, you know, when I heard, you know, Ballroom Blitz was the first explosion into the U.S. And again, I was 10 years old. you know, and I think that record came out in 74, right? Or maybe a year or two before that, somewhere.
That's probably true.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the big one, Ballroom Blitz. And then Fox on the Run, and then Love Is Like Oxygen, and, you know, Little Willie, and, you know, all the others came over after that. But they were popular. I mean, especially to be on AM radio, you know, that, and WLS was probably a bit of an anomaly to play stuff that forward thinking, you know. The Midwest was really, you know, kind of the bands, you know, Rush and Kiss and Ted Nugent, Head East. The Midwest, where I grew up, was really a heart center of hardworking people who loved hard rocking, you know?
Right.
A little less sort of persnickety about trends, you know? It's like, if it rocked and we can crank it up at a keg party, we like it, you know. It's just kind of that simple. So it's no wonder a lot of those groups made their living in the beginning and built their careers in the U.S. based on, you know, the Midwest. Really digging them. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was pretty young. I mean, of course, right after them, you know, Kiss came out, and you know, it's funny with Sweet. And I wasn't aware of it probably as much at the time, but, you know, Alice Cooper was super popular in America. David Bowie. I kind of missed Bowie. Bowie came out like when the song Fame was on the radio. That was super popular.
Right.
Yeah. So I kind of missed all the Ziggy Stardust. I missed most of that stuff. But so, you know, between Bowie, Alice Cooper, and then Sweet, you know, kind of had this glammy thing about them that kind of got pulled in a little bit. The Sweet music was huge. I don't know that their sort of persona translated as well over here, because then right behind that, of course, Kiss came out, you know, and right, you know, when Destroyer dropped in 1976, I mean, Kiss just became the fucking kings, because they, you know, they dropped Destroyer, Rock and Roll Over, Love Gun, like three records in about 18 months with a continuous tour cycle, you know, for just two years or so. They just fucking mounted up big time, you know. So then they became our American heroes, you know.
Yeah, the hustle's now really nice somehow. See the streetcar scene from the black limousine. Shout it out, let it all hang out. But you won't get rough, cause it's all a bluff.
Isn't the Midwest something that is usually forgotten when people talk about the U.S.? It's either the West Coast or the East Coast. You have all the major cities. You have New York on one side, L.A. on yeah. one side, and the Midwest kind of like disappears.
Well, it's funny. When it comes to media, and I think probably most of the stuff that goes out to the world, yeah, you know, New York, L.A., but and of course, Seattle, sort of yeah. changed those rules in the 90s. But, you know, the truth of it is, you know, the bread and butter for a lot of touring bands is they were being like Kiss talked about those first three records up through Alive. That's why, again, Cobo Hall, Detroit, you know, became where Kiss a lot of the Kiss Alive tracks were cut. Rush talked about it because from Toronto over to Buffalo, kind of over to Cleveland. Brought them into Detroit, you know what I mean? So they kind of followed the same thing. What we now call the Rust Belt, you know, they were the iron ore ranges, the steel and automotive industry in Detroit, like those, you know, and even Megadeth, you know, when we, Killing Is My Business tour, you know, of course we formed in LA. Dave was insistent we debut the band up in San Francisco to his, ultimately his, you know, his fan base for Metallica, which was absolutely the right move. Then, you know, Slayer, Megadeth would go to New York, play at L'Amour's. But when we finally did the tour, you know, we started East Coast, Hammer Jackson, Baltimore, New York, and then we immediately cut over and, you know, Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago. I mean, that's that circuit, you know. So, and we've got forever, you know, a great fan base through those cities. And then we've worked all the little ones, Cincinnati and at Dayton and Akron and all the other stuff around it, you know. But, you know, the Midwest here, certainly back in this 70s and 80s, was, you know, kind of the bread and butter for bands to tour and
right.
And develop lifelong fans, you know, not trendy fans. That's the problem on the coasts. Things get trendy,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, and of course, because a lot of the media is there, so they're looking for the next thing, you know. But, you know, the Midwest and even the South, you know, the South back in the sort of the 90s, you know, produced a lot of stuff like Creed, a lot of Florida, Seven Dust, you know, I think Saliva's from Texas. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff kind of, you know, obviously Pantera came out of Texas. So there, that's kind of, you know, produced its own, you know, has it had a, had a pretty good output of a lot of, you know, great rock and roll from America back to, you know, through the 90s.
Yeah.
Another standout track for us was Nailed to the Gun. Obviously, you've been on this radio show before, and we talked about Unleashed in the East, and and you've got Judas Priest opening up the record, and you've got Rob Halford again with this. So that's, that kind of shows you're a bit of a, you know, a bit of a Halford fan. That's for sure.
For sure. Well, look, we got two Halford tracks, and we got two Fast Eddie Clark tracks, right? Between Love Me Like a Reptile and Fast Away.
And Fast Away, of course. Yeah.
Ironically, you know what I mean? It's like, so both Rob and Fast Eddie got sort of a nod to their first solo outings away from Motorhead and Judas Priest. And, you know, it's funny that, that so we did the Rust in Peace Painkiller tour together for 3-4 months with Priest back in 90 and 91. And you know, we'd be at sound check, and you can see the dynamics in the band behind the stage. And the Priest guys were lovely guys, were just nothing but gentlemen to us. But you know, you, every band's got its thing and its hierarchies and its inner workings, you know. So when Rob left, as shocking as it was kind of like, well, you want to do something different, you know. And then of course I've read KK's book, and I know KK now pretty well, and you know, he talked about, like, he was actually putting in his resignation after Painkiller. He's like, fuck this, I'm done with this. I don't know if you've read that or not. He was writing his on the plane flying to L.A. By the time he landed, the news went out that Rob had already quit the band. So the Painkiller tour, I could see it actually happening. you could tell all was not well in Disneyland, you know what I mean? And, hey, people have probably toured with Megadeth and seen the same things going, yeah, shit's fucking weird, man, in Megaland, you know? And, again, this is behind-the-scenes stuff, so you would never talk about this at the time. Now we're, you know, 30 years later, memoirs are written, you know, so I'm just sort of, you know, kind of echoing what they've already written about in their books. But, you know, so to Rob's credits, you know, he went younger, you know, suddenly he went more Pantera, you know. I could tell him and Phil Anselmo were buddies. They were starting to be on all the cover of, you know, Metal Hammer and the big magazines. So he got a bunch of younger musicians, started wearing Doc Martens and shorts, you know, tattoos on his head and everything else. And he went way young in his sound and his look. I remember when they came through Phoenix here, I just moved here and I went to go see them play. It's probably late 93, early 94. And, you know, it was in a small club. And the last time I'd seen Rob, obviously, I think it was at Rock and Rio with us, you know? So, you know, I admired that. It's like, fuck, here's a guy who has been at the top and he's willing to get back down in the trenches. I paid attention to guys like that because I've had to do that in my own career, you know?
Yep.
Megadeth ended in 2002. I had F5. I, you know, had Temple of Brutality. Even the Ellison stuff we do, we're back out playing small little clubs, you know, hot, sweaty clubs to, you know, a bunch of, you know, enthusiastic headbangers. And, you know, watching Steve Harris do it with British Lion, you know, I appreciate his enthusiasm for just wanting to play, you know, and being able to step away from the big spectacle and get back on stage where you have to work for it again. You know, it doesn't, you know, walk on stage with Megadeth, it's like the war is already won. You know what I mean? They're there for us. But when you go out and do some of these smaller things, you know, you've got to get back out and work for it. And I always appreciated Rob in his solo career away from Priest that, you know, he put the time in and you could tell he was passionate about it. So Nailed to the Gun. I covered Nailed to the Gun with F5, actually.
I remember that. Absolutely.
I had Jimmy DeGrasso playing it. In fact, it's funny. The whole reason the idea came to me is we were probably a week into this record and I got a notification on my phone, a YouTube notification to check out F5 Nailed to the Gun. And I went, holy shit, that we got to do that song, you know? I went and I listened to it real quick and, you know, talk about, you know, divine intervention, you know what I mean? It's like, why would that song? I haven't thought of that song in 20 years, especially from F5, you know, and that just shows up right as we're doing a cover record. So
And I called Tom. He goes, well, dude, we got to get Russ Parrish because he was in Fight, you know. So, yeah. Of course, people know him now as Satchel from Steel Panther. And Russ played.
And what a great guitar player he is.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Phenomenal. Yeah. And he played on something for me and Frank Bello on Altitudes and Attitude. He played on a track called Leviathan.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, which I probably should have given him writing credit on. Hell, he turned it into something. It was a bass riff with a, you know, me and his bass and drums. And then he came in and basically was Michael Schenker reinvented, you know, and fleshed it out into this beautiful song, you know. So he's said a wonderful guy, amazing player, you know, he's just great.
He doesn't get enough credit. And also, like, way back before Fight and all this, I think he played with a guy called Kevin Gilbert, who later committed suicide, who he had a band called Toy Matinee, early 90s, phenomenal pop record. And Russ played,
I remember
with
that band.
Kevin Gilbert.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Well, and right as Eddie Van Halen passed away, there was a video that apparently he had done a few weeks earlier with some guys, and he played, they played Unchained.
Right.
And it's just fucking killer, man. And it's, you know, he just plays so good, man. I mean, he's dead on. I think he was in the Atomic Punks for a while, the Van Halen tribute band. So, I mean, the guy is a real player, man. I mean, anytime I get to play with Satchel is count me in, sign me up. You know, he's just amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. It's killer.
How did it feel to play with Jimmy again? You've got a couple of Megadeth drummers here. You've got Jimmy yeah. there, and you've also got Dirk playing as well on a Love Machine.
You know, Jimmy and I have remained friends, you know, through you know, through, and it's funny because I kept going to Dave to not
get rid of Nick Menza. You know, he wanted Jimmy DeGrasso to come in. And, you know, obviously there were some chinks in the armor, and eventually the day came when we had to, you know. But I always liked Jimmy, you know. And it, so I was the one that kind of fought against him coming into Megadeth. And then the day came when it was like, okay, now we got to make the change. So Jimmy came in, and then we became great friends. I mean, we're good buddies. We call up and bullshit about mountain biking and families and real estate. And, you know, we talk about pretty much everything but music most of the time. So I consider him a good friend. And that doesn't always happen when you're in a band with somebody. Sometimes once the band's over, it's like a breakup of a relationship. It's like, fuck those guys. We'll never talk to them again. You know? And so, you know, I try not to be that guy, but it happens. You know, sometimes you just got to distance yourself and move on. And, you know, Chuck Beeler, you know, we brought into play. I reconnected with him. We've been friends for years, and he'll even come out to the Megadeth shows. And we actually let him sit behind the amps and, you know, hang out with her, with the, you know, like he'll sit back there and watch Dirk play and Chris Adler when he played with us. So, you know, Chuck's great, you know, but I brought him out on stage last year on my solo bass story tour, through the Midwest. And I had him play. I said, dude, get up here and freaking play, man. You need to show your face. And he played great. I mean, it was like, God, I stopped in the middle of the show. I'm like, dude, I just fucking remember how much I love playing with you, man. You are just an easy, I just lean back and fall into your pocket, and it's right there. You know what I mean? He's just such a great, great player, you know? So it's fun to have him on here. And of course, Dirk, you know, he and I just got done recording a Megadeth record together. So, it was fun to just have him jump in on this and, you know,
he's an unbelievable drummer as well. He's, obviously he was in Soilwork, you know, one of our Swedish bands. He's one of those super underrated players.
I always say to him, it's like when Scott Travis left Racer X and joined Judas Priest, when Dirk had to depart Soilwork and join Megadeth, you know, suddenly it was this, you know, this sort of visibility for him, you know, and people, and Soilwork's amazing. And, you know, they're great. In fact, at the Remembered Sweden Rock, it was us, then Queen, and then King Diamond played after Queen. And, you know, like 1 a.m. and Dirk was back doing kind of one final show with Soilwork in like the tent behind the King Diamond stage. And, you know, it's small, like 100 people there or something, but these guys are in there just shredding and chopping. And it's like, fuck, dude, it's like, that's a lot of work, you know, and plus to play two sets, you know, to play a Megadeth show. But the abilities of Dirk are just unbelievable, you know, and, it was fun to cut a Megadeth record with him. You know, we've done a lot of touring, but it was fun to cut new tracks with him, and I'm glad he'll get his, sort of his day in the sun as a recorded Megadeth drummer. We'll be right back.
Trick. We kind of skipped over that. It's another song, you know, it's got Al Jorgensen, but it really, really works. He works on that song.
Yeah. Well, Al is from Chicago. Cheap Trick from a little town over called Rockford. Charlie Benante from now lives in Chicago. So it's kind of the Chicago contingent there. But, you know, Al, who lives in L.A. now, you know, and we've been buddies for quite a while, for a good decade or so.
Were you going to play with Ministry at one stage?
You know, I was going to. I actually brought Jimmy DeGrasso in. I was working for PB at the time, and it didn't quite fit because of, you know, they had a pretty ambitious tour planned. And I was like, I can't really step away that long to do it. But that's when we hooked up, met up, and became friends. I've been a big fan of his. Actually, we got in a room and did a little writing on some stuff, too, this summer. You know, so that kind of led to, we started a discussion about Alvita Zane. So he sang on that. Got in the room with him and Billy Morrison. We just put some guitars in our hands, did some jamming, you know, so, and who knows where that goes, but it's just fun to kind of lift up the hood and plug in and fucking go and make some music together. So, you know, it's fun to do these things, you know, you know, Al is not a guy who guests on a lot of stuff. So I was really appreciative that him and his girl Liz, you know, helped make that happen. Because, and like Al said, he goes, like, Cheap Trick is this one band we can all agree on. Guy, girl, teeny bopper, old guys, whoever, you know what I mean? It's like everybody can agree on Cheap Trick. And Van Halen and Cheap Trick, like, everybody can agree that there's some song in those catalogs that is like, that you, yeah, I love that song, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. And I think for us harder rockers, Alvita Zane is the one we tend to go to. And the Heaven Tonight record, you know, again, for my generation, was the real sweet spot, you know. You know, there's got to, as we know, as rockers, we love our bands when they're our own.
Yeah.
When they put out the big hit and they go off and become everybody else's band, then they don't like them as much. You know, there's something about when we discover it and there are, you know, AC/DC with Power Age and Let There Be Rock and Cheap Trick with In Color and, you know, Heaven Tonight. And then once they do Budokan and every girl at the prom likes them, it's like, you know, it's not a specialty, you know.
But writing with Al, what kind of music do you come up with?
You know, I can't really talk too much about that, but just, I probably shouldn't have even mentioned it, but because again, I don't know where it's going to go, but it was just fun. Again, it was kind of more just, oh, let's fucking just plug in and jam, you know? I mean, I'm here at your house, let's go. And it was just, it was a great moment, you know, to just, you know, and those things, sometimes it's fun to do that without having an objective. Obviously, when I called Al for Alvita Zane, we had the track recorded. We wanted him to be the guest on the record. So there was an objective to him being on the track. But us doing some jamming was more about, I don't know, it's like the first date, you know? It's like, I don't know, is there any magic here, you know? Like, let's just plug in and jam. And it is like that with musicians, you know, it's kind of like, is there a vibe? Sometimes you play with people and it just doesn't click. That's why I don't like all-star supergroup bands, because, you know, you're putting the cart before the horse. You know, I'd rather play with my friends like we did on this record, play with my friends. They're all famous because we all grew up together. And when I go to meet a drummer, I'll call Dirk or Lombardo or Charlie, you know, those are the guys I call. If I need a guitar player, you know, we call Satchel, you know, I don't call the guy down the street usually, you know, just because of when you've had these experiences as a recording artist. And that's not to discount any other players. I've played with a lot of great unknown players who are amazing, but for whatever reason, the career didn't swing their way. The band they were in broke up. They didn't get the chance to go to the big dance and, you know, and be sort of a superstar celebrity musician. So I don't use fame as a benchmark. I use experience and stylistically, what do we need on this track? You know, which is why with Dirk, you know, that double bass thing for Love Machine, it's like, you know, let's call Dirk, man. That's, he does that in his sleep, you know? And Charlie, knowing Charlie is a fan of these tracks and he plays well out of Dead Kennedys, like that's right up his alley. You know, Charlie's a really tight player. So I kind of go more stylistically with what the song needs. That was really the more the benchmark on this, with inviting guests in, and the fact that it, you know, has kind of an all-star listing of guests was a complete secondary thing that happened from it. And I'm glad we did it, because I think it's more fun to have the party with all your friends coming over to the house too. You know, yeah. I don't like to be a solo project. I'd rather be part of the community. You know, I think it's more fun together.
You mentioned Jimmy DeGrasso. Jimmy DeGrasso played in Y&T. You should do a Y&T song for the next one.
Well, you know, it's funny. Jimmy and I and Kerry Kelly from Night Ranger, who now plays a Night Ranger, and Kerry Kelly was in Alice Cooper's band. Jimmy and Kerry probably lived together on tour and played together for 15 years, you know, in Allison's band. And, you know, Jimmy kept calling, going, dude, we got to do something. And I was like, all right, well, so we started talking about some people, and I had a couple of people that I was thinking I'd love to get out of the house, and not everybody's up for that. Some people are like, nope, it's COVID. I'm staying home. I'm not going anywhere. And so, Carrie, who I know, and, amazing player, and a great songwriter. You know, so we started throwing some files back and forth on email, and Carrie sent some tunes. I'm like, damn, dude, they're fucking great. I mean, you don't even need us. You can just do it on your own, you know. But we got in a room. We went to Mates in North Hollywood, and me and Jimmy and Carrie for a couple of days and worked on some tracks. And so we've actually been, you know, throwing some ideas around, and we'll see what comes of that. So it's, you know, one thing about Jimmy is he's ambitious, you know. He's not sitting back just waiting. Obviously he's deserving of a big gig, as he's had with Black Star Writers and Alice Cooper and Megadeth and David Lee Roth and all this stuff. But, you know, in the meantime, I'm always about, look, until the big gig swings around again, let's keep working, you know, let's keep playing, let's keep writing, let's stay in the game. You know, so, you know, that's kind of what a lot of this is, you know, all of our Megadeth stuff is pushed back till, you know, a year from now. And so it's like, well, rather than sit around and go dark, keep playing, you know, let's keep our chops up. Let's keep our studio ears on, you know, let's keep our friendships together with everybody. And, you know, to me, that's what No Cover represents, all of that. It isn't just an album by a dude with some songs. It's more representative of a COVID community really coming together. You know, all the friendships, and we all, again, what brings us all together? The songs, the music always brought us. They always made the keg party better in high school, and they, you know, and they make the party, the COVID party, a lot more fun too, you know.
Yeah. was there any people that you couldn't get that you really wanted on here but just couldn't get for logistical reasons or whatever?
The only person I called that couldn't was Christina Scabbia. She, of course, lives in Northern Italy. And she just said, look, I can't even get it to a studio. I'm locked in my house. I can't get to the studio. The engineer's not available. So I said, no worries. I, you know, you're always on my speed dial for stuff. But she was the only one. And it was just restricted. That was literally right when, you know, they got hit pretty hard up there in Northern Italy.
Oh, it was really bad. Yeah.
By like early mid June, they were not out of the clear yet. So, you know, I just had to let that one go.
Yeah. I remember last time you were over, when we were sitting in the taxi, you know, talking about a lot of things, I was surprised at how still after all these years, you're still hungry and you're still doing this and doing, you know, working with Frank and, you know, you're juggling a lot of balls. It's great.
I love it, man. I mean, look, you know, I got sobered up in 1990, you know, and that gave me clarity, of course. It gave me more energy. You know, I try to lead a pretty healthy lifestyle, you know, and that, you know, I'm not waking up at noon, shaking off a hangover and, you know, doing that anymore. So that, you know, kind of gets me back to the, like, okay, well, what did I do when I was 12, 13 years old? I'd wake up, look for my bass, call some buddies. Hey, you know, Greg Handovit, who played on Love Me Like a Reptile, you know, we met in fifth grade in the hallway of elementary school over a discussion about Kiss. I mean, that's how long me and Greg have known each other, you know? So, and that's why I said, hey, dude, you got to jump in and play on this song. Cause we used to play Love Me Like a Reptile in our high school bands, you know? You know, so to me, I'm kind of the same guy that I was back then, you know, especially when it comes to music, you know, you know, I've gotten to enjoy, you know, obviously a great career doing this. And I think always, you know, when something that's sort of your, you know, virtue or your gift becomes your vocation, there's always a danger that it's not so fun anymore. You know, it's like I hate to say it when people go, oh, I got to go to work. And it's like, wait. Playing guitar is not work, you know, and I realize it's a job in the sense that you've been hired and you're being paid and maybe there's a contract of employment. I get all that, of course, but man, you know, it can't, when it becomes work, work's a four letter word and not a good one, you know? So it's like, that's the whole reason we started doing this is so we didn't have to get a job, you know? So I try never to look at this like that. In fact, one day I think I was complaining to a friend of mine and I said, you know, I have to go to Europe and then I got to go to South America. And go, wait. You get to go to Europe. You get to go to South America. He goes, most of us sit here in one zip code most of our whole life. We don't get to do shit. You know, and that really reframed it. And I was just being grumpy that one day. And I was like, yeah, you know what? And so all the years back, you know, in the 90s, we'd be flying to Europe. And I remember Nick Menza. Nick was like a lot of musicians in that when he was home, he couldn't wait to get on tour. And as soon as he got on tour, he couldn't wait to be home, you know? And I remember sitting on the plane, we were flying to Europe again. We went many times back and forth and the jet lag beats the shit out of you. You know, I mean, the travel can really beat you up, but I was just going, you know, one day this will be the last time we do this and we're not going to know because, and then sure enough in 2002, Dave calls up and says, hey, I quit Megadeth. Like, fuck, there it is. That's the call. And a part of me is kind of going, that can't be the end. It might be the end for a little while, you know, and of course that's what it was. It was a temporary ending. Unfortunately it came back, but you know, I realized that happens to a lot of people. Like they're grooving, rocking, someone overdoses, you know, a car crash. I mean, fuck, who knows? Cancer, you know, something happens and it really is over. And that's the record company drops them. You know, in the early 90s, everybody's playing rock and roll, and then Nirvana shows up and it's a new sheriff's in town, and record company goes, yep, we don't like heavy metal anymore. Goodbye, you know. And all of a sudden it's like, holy shit. So I mean, I feel very blessed that I have been able to, you know, be in the music business and make music my whole life. And that's what it's centered around. And so again, the celebration of that, you know, to go back to my heroes and dig through my record collection again and go, yeah, these are the guys that got me into this thing, you know, and these are the guys that, this is why I did this, you know? So it's cool to give a nod back to them, especially as a lot of them are dying. You know, Steve Priest passed away, Pete Way passed away. And even though he wasn't in Fast Way, he was supposed to be in Fast Way back in the day.
Eric Carr, IJ from Twisted Sister.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's, you know, guys are, you know, Lemmy, you know, and that's why Tom put sort of a, you know, in honor of in the liner notes, he put a whole bunch of, you know, of people, even a couple of Megadeth members, Gar Samuels and Nick Menza, you know, so sort of a rest in peace. Thank you for all you did for us thing, you know, because there's a lot of people that have influenced us. And, you know, again, that's the thing. I think probably now at age 56 for me, I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. If not now, when? Like, go.
Yeah.
You know, we're not guaranteed. We're not promised today. We certainly aren't promised and guaranteed a tomorrow. So it's like, if we're not going to do this shit, when are we going to do it? You know, so let's saddle up and get going.
Yeah.
mentioned Wasp and Love Machine. Yeah. And yeah. when you came to, did you come to LA in like 1982 or something?
83. In fact, right as I would, we'd go out, Dave and I would go out to like the Troubadour. You know, there was the Troubadour in Santa Monica. And then up on, of course, there's, you know, the Whiskey, the Rainbow, Gazzari's, all that stuff at that time. But the Troubadour seemed to be the place where I saw bands for whatever reason. And I remember going, and Wasp had just played. We missed it. It was packed. Couldn't even get in. Wasp had played, and it was their last show. I think it was kind of like their final showcase for Capitol Records as they were getting signed, and Rod Smallwood was managing them, and they were off. So by the time I got to L.A., the US Festival had just happened. So Motley was taking off. Quiet Riot was taking off, you know, number one on MTV. Wasp got signed. Rat had been signed. Armored Saint was just getting signed. You know, Dio's first, you know, Holy Diver had come out. So he'd gone solo. Fast Eddie went solo with Fastway. So great freaking era. Great time to be in L.A., man. I mean, just so much great music. And it was all hard rock and heavy metal. And it was all over the radio and. So cool.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Jesus. Yeah. Nice.
Just to bring it to a close, tear it loose, Twisted Sister. This is one of the few, this and Nailed to the Gun had Russ on there. This has got Eddie on there. One of the only two tracks I think that had some of the original players from that song.
Yeah.
How's your, you know, Eddie quite well?
Yeah. In fact, my Ellison Coffee Company, we actually produce a coffee for him. We do an Eddie Ojeda dark and twisted roast coffee for him. But Tom's a huge Twisted fan. You know, when I got to LA, of course, Motley was sort of the West Coast version of that. Twisted was the East Coast version, you know, and Twisted was starting to take off, Stay Hungry. And now they were on MTV and everything. So, so for Tom, 10 years younger than me, you know, I always say I quit buying records in 1983, and that was the year Tom started buying records. So he started buying all the stuff that I just talked about. He's a huge Twisted fan, and so he hit Eddie, and he said, he goes, you know, let's get you on a track. Would you want to do a Twisted song? And he said, yeah, let's do Tear It Loose. So that was his idea. Really cool that he played the solo on it, because normally JJ French plays the solo on that track. So yeah, it was very cool too. And again, one of the deeper cuts, you know, one of the heavier, more fucking locomotive tracks, you know, instead of like the popular hit.
Yeah
love it.
Yeah.
Excellent, man.
All right,
I think we got it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, thank you.